I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
As Iraqis wait for the changes that the June 30th transfer of power will bring, Americans too are waiting, eager to know when U.S. troops in Iraq will come home. That was one of the questions put to Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz this morning on Capitol Hill. Representative Ike Skelton, Democrat from Missouri and a member of the House Armed Services Committee, pressed Wolfowitz for a timetable.
Tell us what your measurement is for success, for Americans to say we've succeeded and to bring the troops home. At what point? People ask me this. I have no answer.
When it becomes an Iraqi fight and the Iraqis are prepared to take on the fight, they're prepared to join their security forces, we are prepared to arm and equip them to do it. I can't tell you how long that's going to take. It's dangerous. I remember when people were up here 8 years ago saying we'd be in Bosnia only for a year. We are finally about to end the Bosnian mission, 8 years later?
Is it your testimony you think we might be there then a good number of years?
I think it's entirely possible, but what I think is also nearly certain is the more they step up, and they will be doing so more and more each month, the less and less we will have to do. If American forces, simply by being there and without having to enter the combat, can enable Iraqi forces to succeed, that'll be huge progress.
Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz.
Meanwhile, South Korea is evacuating the remaining 22 South Korean nationals working in Iraq while waiting for word of Kim Sun-il, the kidnapped translator who works for a company that provides supplies to the U.S. military. Kim's captors threaten to behead him unless South Korea drops its plan to send 3,000 additional soldiers to the region in August, something the South Koreans have refused to do. Andrew Ward covers South Korea for the Financial Times of London. He joins us on the line from Seoul. Andrew, Dubai Television says Kim Sun-il is still alive despite yesterday's deadline. Do you have any new word?
Well, there are lots of conflicting reports, but a few hopeful indications that he could indeed still be alive. Some religious groups in the Middle East are claiming that they've had contact with the insurgent group that is holding him, and they claim that he's still alive. The South Korean government is cautiously saying that it is pursuing various diplomatic channels to try and secure his release. And indeed, it's been reported on Arab TV that indeed the deadline for his execution has been set back.
We understand from our reading that a South Korean security company says that there was an Iraqi go-between that saw him alive. Does that mean that there's negotiation going on?
Well, the South Korean government has been quite open about negotiating insofar as pursuing all possible channel through which it might secure his release. So they are saying that they are talking to religious groups. They are trying to make contact with the insurgents group. However, what it's saying also is that it will not give in to the terrorist demands. It will not accept the demand for them to cancel the dispatch of an additional 3,600 troops to Iraq. It will not accept the demand to remove the 600 Korean troops that are already in the country. So it's not clear what sort of negotiations are going on.
Andrew, what are people saying on the streets of South Korea? We remember that when Japanese hostages were captured in Iraq several months ago, they were viewed with hostility by the Japanese public. They were seen to bring shame on Japan. How are South Koreans reacting to Kim?
Yeah, I don't think there will be the same reaction to this man. I think Kim is actually being viewed with a lot of sympathy here at home. He's seen as the innocent victim of politics. He was a contract worker, an Arab linguist, an Arab specialist who has been employed as a translator for a company supplying the U.S. military. He was apparently there to earn money to pay for his language studies and was also working in his spare time as a missionary. And there is huge sympathy on the streets. There have been candlelight vigils in support of him, and some protests calling for the government to accept the terrorist demand for the Koreans to pull their troops out of Iraq.
We understand that there are 600 military medics and engineers currently in Iraq. The plan is to send 3,000 more troops. Just briefly before we let you go, we understand that other South Korean companies have been reacting to the hostage taking by beefing up security.
at the outset of the war in Iraq and then the subsequent efforts to stabilize it, there was a lot of excitement almost in Korea about the prospect of big business contracts for big Korean companies such as Hyundai and Samsung. And really that has all now turned very sour, and it has become clear that Iraq is not the golden business opportunity that people had previously thought it might be. And indeed we now see that Korea is pulling out all of its businessmen from the country because of the threat to their security. Mm. And of course this has implications for the rebuilding of Iraq, because it's businessmen from companies such as Korean businesses, which are there to supply the U.S. military and to aid reconstruction. And so this kidnapping has further undermined those efforts to stabilize the country.
Andrew Ward covers South Korea for the Financial Times of London. He's speaking to us from Seoul. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chechen rebels attacked the city of Ingushetia in southern Russia early today, killing dozens of people, including three high-ranking government officials. Joining us on the line is Scott Peterson, Moscow bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. And Scott, what happened?
What we've seen overnight has been a very strong, very well-organized attack on perhaps 20 different organs, if you will, that represent the state. These are administrative offices, police checkpoints. It's still not entirely clear who is responsible nor where these people have gone. The authorities are blaming Chechen rebels. Sources that I've spoken to say that beside Chechens, there may also be some Ingush and Dagestanis who are engaged in this, but certainly one of the most brazen attacks in recent years by Chechen rebels, if they are in fact the ones who carried this out.
Well, and as we know, the fighting has been going on there for some 5 years. What does this latest attack or series of attacks tell us about whether President Putin is going to be able to contain the violence in southern Russia?
Well, I think this is another indication that the Kremlin is not able to control the violence there. I mean, certainly that they have made, from their perspective, a lot of progress in the last 2 years. They have knocked out many of the larger armed formations that had been rebel entities in Chechnya. But then again, just when they think that they are making progress and say that they're making progress, then there's a strike like this, which reminds everybody that really there isn't a military solution, or hasn't been so far. Just a few days ago, there were reports, there was an interview that was made with the Chechen separatist leader who promised that basically the rebels were going to shift their tactics. They were going to change from doing kind of small-time hit-and-run sabotage attacks, and that they were going to now begin launching, quote, big attacks, unquote. And in fact, that is precisely what we seem to have seen today.
And what do you make of the fact that there were reports in the West, at least, that some of the fighters were shouting, Allahu Akbar? What does that tell us about who these rebels are and perhaps where they might be getting some of their support and some of their funding?
Well, in this case, that would clearly point normally to fighters that would have an Islamist bent to them. How hardcore or not they may be remains to be seen. And in fact, the current mix in Chechnya of rebels is hard to determine. In fact, it's always been difficult to determine, because originally this conflict was one of fighting for a separatist Chechnya, separation from Russia. But then. In the last 5 years that this fighting has been going on, there has been a large influx not only of some Islamist commanders, but also of jihadis that are not Chechens but are wanting to get some experience in Chechnya. These are people who've come, were trained, some of them in Afghanistan, others who fought in Bosnia and other places. Normally these would be the type of people who would be members of al-Qaeda. And certainly Moscow has cast this fight as their version of the war against terror, the same one that Washington was fighting in Afghanistan and says it's fighting in Iraq.
Scott, thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Thanks.
Scott Peterson is Moscow bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
An article in today's New York Times caught our eye. Columnist Paul Krugman accuses Attorney General John Ashcroft of letting his politics distort his policies. Krugman says Ashcroft doesn't trumpet the arrest of alleged terrorists who don't fit his storyline, who aren't, in other words, Muslim. Krugman cites as evidence William Carr, arrested last year after authorities found his huge cache of weapons, including a cyanide bomb that could have killed everyone in a 30,000-square-foot building. Ashkar's in prison. But why is it that his case didn't merit a single press release from the Ashcroft Justice Department, unlike accused dirty bomber Jose Padilla, the Muslim convert who didn't have a bomb? Jim Kessler, a Washington-based speechwriter, posed the same question in a column for UPI.com. He joins us on the line. Jim, why do you think William Krar didn't make big headlines in the Justice Department?
Well, I think that's a $64,000 question. I think that the arrest of Krar probably stopped the most significant terrorist attack planned in the United States since September 11th, and it's the proverbial tree that fell in the woods. Nobody knows about it. And it's from a Justice Department that is not shy about trumpeting its accomplishments.
Now, as you write, they've written 2,295 news releases since his appointment, and not one of them has mentioned William Krar. Who is William Krar?
William Krar is a white supremacist who has traveled around the country, lived in New Hampshire, lived in Texas, lived in other places. He traveled around in gun shows buying and selling guns. He had a small cadre of followers, and he amassed a huge arsenal of weapons, including fully automatic weapons, pipe bombs, briefcase bombs, sodium cyanide, which is a dangerous chemical weapon, and he had plans to use them.
Well, Paul Krugman today writes that John Ashcroft is close to the gun lobby, that in fact, post 9/11, he specifically prohibited the FBI from examining background checks on gun purchasers as opposed to, let's say, immigration lists, and that that had something to do with his not trumpeting this case. Your thoughts?
I always suspected that the reason why the Krar case was not brought up was because Krar seemed to fit the profile of someone who frequented gun shows. There was legislation pending to close the gun show loophole, and I thought that, you know, this was one of the reasons the Justice Department just didn't want to have this out there. Now, since his conviction, it is known that Krar frequented gun shows quite a bit, and I do think it had something to do with it. In fact, it might be the major reason why this arrest was not trumpeted by the Justice Department.
Well, Jim, as you know, you're a partisan on this topic, policy director for Americans for Gun Safety. And a Justice Department spokesperson we spoke to said that Krugman's article on this theory is hate-filled, vitriolic liberal rant, that the Justice Department more often than not doesn't publicize cases. They want to keep them quiet to protect them as they go to court. Your thoughts?
Well, this is very unusual that a case this large there would not be at least a mention by the Justice Department. I think it's a shocking omission, and it really says something about the mindset over there. My concern is that when there is something that the American people should know about, a major terrorist threat that involves a different kind of terrorist, the more the Timothy McVeigh type, that the American people are not informed about it, I think that's a travesty.
As you write, a double standard.
A double standard, absolutely.
Jim Kessler, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jim Kessler, president of the Washington-based consulting firm Definition Strategy and a columnist for UPI.com. Just ahead, Farmingville, New York, a small town on Long Island, finds itself in the middle of a big debate about illegal immigration.
And later in the program, grading Governor Schwarzenegger.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
Farmingville, New York is a quiet town in the suburbs of Long Island. In the late 1990s, it became a magnet for immigrants from Mexico who found jobs in the building, landscaping, and restaurant industries. But as more and more men stood on street corners hoping to be hired, longtime residents organized to preserve what they saw as their quality of life. Several years of struggle between immigrants and townspeople has been captured now in a new film called Farmingville.
This issue in Farmingville, this situation that's being played out on a local level, is really one of the defining things that America is going through. Are we an immigrant nation or aren't we? We're really fighting for the heart and souls of who we are going to be as Americans. And we're fighting for the hearts and souls of who we are going to be with a large influx of Hispanic immigrants, both documented and undocumented. There is a browning of America.
Farmingville, the documentary, won a special jury prize at the 2004 Sundance Film Festival. It premieres on the PBS POV series tonight. And filmmakers Carlos Sandoval and Catherine Tambini join us from the studios of Barnstable Broadcasting on Long Island. Carlos, I want to start with you and ask, what was it about this story that first captured your attention?
What really captured me was, in a sense, self-preservation, fear. I was living out and do live out in the eastern end of Long Island, and I was concerned about the reaction of residents in the Hamptons to the growing community of Latinos out there, people referring to Latinos as an invasion of locusts. And when you get referred to as an insect, your own antenna kind of goes up. Mm. Within a month or so, the unfortunate situation took place where two skinheads came in from outside of Farmingville to the town of Farmingville, perhaps attracted by some of the tensions there, and beat two day laborers in a case of hate-based attempted murder. And it was really the headline that appeared in News Today that said they wanted to get some Mexicans, language that I thought I'd never see or hear again, having grown up in the Southwest before the civil rights. So I thought this was a story that needed to be told.
And so you rented a house in Farmingville and got out your camera, started pointing it around. Did you have some notion of what you were after, or did you just want to hear what everyone had to say about this and see where the story went next?
A bit of clarification, unfortunately. Catherine's a camera person. She really was the one that got out the camera. But I did have a sense of the story, at least I thought I did, in terms of the debate surrounding specifically a hiring hall as a means of providing a partial solution to the men standing on the street corners in Farmingville, which was causing a lot of the concern, frustration among the residents.
Well, and Catherine, as Carlos rightly points out, you were the person behind the camera, and I've read that it was very important for you and Carlos to show all the sides of this story.
Yes, we really wanted to take a balanced view. We wanted to humanize the situation, make you feel the way that it would be to stand in the shoes of the Mexican immigrant who had to leave his family and cross the desert and come someplace foreign so that he could feed his family. We wanted you to feel how it would be to be a resident living in a house where there are 30 men living in a residential house right next door to you. And we wanted you to feel what it would be to be an official in a town trying to make sense of the issues and struggling to deal with the problems in the community.
Well, along the way, you talked to one contractor who didn't want to identify himself, but who was very blunt about why he uses illegal immigrants.
Last year, I put an ad in the paper for Americans. I said, let me give it a shot. And it was a joke. These kids, it's just a joke. They work for 2 weeks, and then they start not showing up. And, you know, just complain and mope around, you know. I won't be in business if I have to. It just doesn't work.
That clip from the new documentary film Farmingville. Carlos, it sounds like the old argument, you know, illegal immigrants are simply filling jobs that Americans don't want, won't take.
I think that is the case. We've been taking the film across the country, and recently in Florida, there was a contractor who said that he had taken out an ad offering full benefits, including health, a vacation package, good wages, and he ran that ad for several weeks and found no one who was documented who could take the job.
Also in the film, we hear a great deal from a woman who is leading the opposition, who is very outspoken about the impact that she sees on the community.
They do not have the right to work here. They do not have the right to live here. They do not have the right to destroy my community and my home and my rights.
That is Margaret Biancooley, who, believe it or not, she and I are good friends. I admire Margaret in many ways, so long as we don't talk politics. But she's an extremely intelligent individual with a great sense of humor. And I think someone who was really fighting for what she felt to be the way in which she felt to believe she needed to fight for her community.
Well, and it does sound like a legitimate point. I mean, who would like sudden crowds of people, no matter where they came from, suddenly moving into your neighborhood, standing around on the street corners?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a number of legitimate complaints that the residents of Farmingville have. That's not to say that there aren't some racists in Farmingville. I was actually on a number of times harassed as I'd be walking down the street and have cars veering at me, calling out epithets.
Well, Catherine, one of the things that comes through loud and clear in the film is that just how hot emotions got. You know, people were doing a lot more screaming at each other than they were listening to each other. Do you think there is some common ground that can be found here?
I think that there is. I think that's the point. People need to listen to each other. If you don't listen to each other, how can you figure out a common ground where you can find solutions? And that's one of the main purposes of our film, so that we can go into communities that are having these sorts of problems with integrating new groups of people and begin a dialogue.
Well, thank you both, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Gail.
Carlos Sandoval and Catherine Tambini's new film, Farmingville, is scheduled to air tonight on PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable about the complications of living a life while covering a war.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger struck a deal yesterday with five Indian tribes who wanted to expand their gambling operations.
It brings at least $1 billion of additional state revenue for this year, which I, of course, will dedicate to desperately needed transportation projects. In addition, this agreement will generate between $150 and $200 million a year in ongoing state revenue, which is important for California.
Well, back when Schwarzenegger ran for office, he attacked the tribes as a special interest group that didn't pay its fair share of taxes, all of which, some observers say, is typical of this actor-turned-governor: attack, then charm, then compromise. In this week's New Yorker magazine, writer Connie Brooks says even some skeptics think he's doing a good job, at least for now. She joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Welcome, Connie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Connie, do you see Arnold's success as the logical follow-on to the celebrification of politics, sort of governor as action hero?
I do. I mean, very much I do. Although I have to say that, you know, although he's used his celebrity so much to his advantage, he's got other things going for him as well.
I would imagine that one of the tricks to Hollywood would also be you have to get along with a lot of different people. Essentially, Schwarzenegger has learned to get people to do what he wants them to do.
Yes, he absolutely has. And I would say that actually that goes back even before his movie career, that strange as it sounds, that it goes back to his years as a world champion in bodybuilding, because he achieved his championships there not only because he had the physical requirements and he had the tenacity to just push himself, but also because he was so psychologically adroit. And he was very famous, as shown in that movie Pumping Iron, he was very famous for his ability to zero in on the weaknesses, strengths and weaknesses of his competitors. And he just became an incredible manipulator. So he got people to do what he wanted then, and he's getting them to do what he wants today.
Well, and as you write, he seems to have had an incredible sense of destiny from childhood. He's bought up embarrassing photos and film outtakes and has dealt preemptively with his father's relationship with the Nazi Party. Do you think politics was his goal all along?
I really do. I don't think there's actually any question. I mean, when he, as I mentioned, when he was 20 and he went to visit Reg Park, who was a bodybuilding champion in South Africa and who was his idol, he told him at that time that he wanted to follow in his footsteps. He wanted to become first a world champion bodybuilder, then a movie star, then direct movies, then go into politics. And that was when he was 20 years old and was just this, you know, he had just become Mr. Universe, I guess. But, I mean, he was an Austrian. I mean, he hadn't come to this country yet. There was nothing to suggest that, you know, that he could achieve anything like what he was saying. And then people who knew him, you know, here in this country, he came in 1968. And in the 70s, people who knew him did say that he talked about going into politics ultimately.
And now, a few months into his time as governor, as you point out, he is very popular for achieving what he said he would. But the question you raise is, are his solutions the right ones to the state's problems? Can you give us some examples?
Well, you know, it's not, the thing is that while he's achieved them, he's been very clever because he has set certain goals and he's defined them as success, and then he achieves them. But it's a question about whether the goals are really as great as he says they are. For example, the workers' comp deal that he reached, he's just trumpeted it as something that is going to solve California's problems with workers' compensation. And he claims that from the deal that he made that there will be billions and billions of dollars of savings. But really, there's very little at this point to suggest that that is necessarily true. And also now he's just proposed a budget, and they're trying to actually, you know, to get a budget in the next few days to get the legislature to agree on it. But there, too, he's done more of what used to be done. He's tended to put off the hard decisions and not address the sort of underlying really, really tough issues. So a lot of it appears more cosmetic than fundamental.
Well, and actually, as you point out, this Legislative Analyst Office report that in the short term, things may look better, but in the long term, maybe not.
That's exactly right. And that's a nonpartisan, highly regarded office.
So how is it that he is able to get this democratically controlled legislature to give him things that they would not give Gray Davis?
Well, it's a combination of things. One thing is that I think the Democratic legislators were all pretty shaken up by the recall when Davis was recalled. And it's true, too, that the legislature, not the individual legislators, but the legislature as a body is very unpopular in California. And they don't want to be seen as the problem. Schwarzenegger, whenever he wants to get them to agree to something, you know, goes out to the public and says the legislators are the problem.
Sure. They looked at those recall numbers and they got it.
Exactly.
How much of a secret weapon is his wife, Maria Shriver?
She's a formidable secret weapon. I mean, one thing is that the other thing I didn't mention, I mean, he's threatened the legislators, but he's also tried to charm them. And he's made an ally of John Burton, the Senate Majority Leader, who is the single most important person who could have blocked the things that Schwarzenegger wants, and instead he's made Burton his ally. But also, as Burton said to me, how bad of a Republican can you be if you're married to a Kennedy? And then she is herself very, you know, she can be very charming and winning, so she's a huge asset. I mean, he's a lot of his success so far does spring from the fact that he's embraced this bipartisanship to a very surprising degree, and Maria is a critical element in that.
Hmm. He also has a running joke in which he thanks people for changing the Constitution so that he can run for president and then accepts the nomination and says, oh, no, wrong speech. I mean, is that really a joke, or do you think that's where he's heading?
It's not a joke. He says it's a joke. I asked him about it, and he you know, protests that it's a joke. But I don't think that anyone who knows Arnold well thinks that that's a joke. A friend of his, Franco Colombo, who's known him since they were bodybuilders together in the 60s, told me that there's no question in his mind that the presidency is Arnold's, you know, more long-term goal. He has to get the constitutional amendment through, but for that, you know, he thinks that it is his goal.
Connie, thank you.
Thank you.
Connie Bruck writes for The New Yorker magazine. Her article on Governor Schwarzenegger appears in this week's issue.
Still to come, a small independent bookstore in Harlem gets ready for a presidential book signing.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Martina Navratilova has won 18 Grand Slam titles, 31 doubles, 9 singles titles at Wimbledon. But yesterday she got perhaps her sweetest victory yet, beating an opponent 23 years her junior to become, at 47, the oldest player since 1922 to win a Wimbledon singles. Eleanor Preston, a tennis writer for The Guardian, is at Wimbledon. And Eleanor, how did the crowd respond when Martina won in what seemed like just a few minutes, when she beat Colombia's Catalina Castano? What was the crowd reaction?
Well, she wrapped that match up in under an hour, so that was certainly a surprising element. I don't think anybody expected her to beat her opponent that quickly. However, I mean, I think there was a hugely warm response from the Wimbledon crowd. You know, they're a knowledgeable crowd, and they know what Navratilova's achievements mean, and they know how big an achievement it is to win that first-round match.
What is it about her game that made her so spectacular?
Well, she's a serve and volleyer, so that does exactly what it says on the tin, in that she serves and then she comes to the net as quickly as she can, and not many people play like that in today's modern game, and I think that's what took Castano by surprise.
Yeah, especially young girls today, they stay at the baseline, we're told.
That's right, they stay at the baseline and perhaps try and use power from the baseline to win their matches. Navratilova doesn't quite boast that kind of power anymore for obvious reasons, so she had to use a bit of nous, a bit of guile, and a bit of brain power.
What's that like? What does that look like, and what's that like to watch?
Well, it's great to watch, especially if you've got somebody coming forward and then somebody at the baseline. That, as we sort of purists say, that's the ideal tennis match to watch, for obvious reasons. But I think it's fun. It's a sort of cut and thrust of somebody coming to the net and swashbuckling their way through to a really creditable win.
How does she look? Some people are thinking 47 years old. A lot of major athletes have, you know, completely fallen apart at that point.
That's right. Well, she's raising the bar for athletes of any age, but certainly for athletes into their late 40s. I mean, I think that's an amazing achievement. But she looked great. You know, she looked fast. She looked quick. Her reflexes are probably a little less quick than they were 15, 20 years ago, but that's understandable. But she made up for it in other ways, and she certainly has put a massive effort into her fitness.
What's the thinking? How far will she go?
Well, I don't think it's realistic to expect her to be winning her 10th Wimbledon singles title here, but I think it's realistic to expect her to win perhaps her next match. Goran Ivanišević spoke very warmly. I think a lot of players respect her achievements here, as I say, and it's reassuring for players who are entering into their early 30s and feeling their career might be over to see someone who's 47 out there and still doing it.
Yeah. She now faces the player who beat her at the French Open last month. What's the expectation in the next round?
I think she's going to want to take revenge over Gisela Dulco after that first round loss at the French Open, because Martina is an extremely competitive person, and it goes without saying that she's going to want to redress the balance of that loss. I think it's realistic to expect her to give Dulco a match. I'm not sure whether she's capable of winning two singles matches in a row, but I think she's surprised so many people down the years, and particularly here, that you can't rule out her pulling off another surprise.
Yeah, she was a wild card ticket, Navratilova, coming in. That was a controversial decision. Is it seen as being controversial now?
I think it's a lot less controversial now. She's proved that she is able to stay with people by winning a first-round match. I think that probably took a lot of the heat off the organizers who gave her a wild card, if you like.
Eleanor, thank you.
Pleasure.
Eleanor Preston, tennis writer for Britain's Guardian, speaking to us from Wimbledon.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Before last night's official release, and despite decidedly mixed reviews, former president and author Bill Clinton's biography, My Life, debuted at number one on Amazon.com, and the 6-CD audio set is not far behind, ranking in the top 10.
In February 1997, Monica was among the guests at an evening taping of my weekly radio address, after which I met with her alone again for about 15 minutes. I was disgusted with myself for doing it, and in the spring when I saw her again, I told her that it was wrong for me, wrong for my family, and wrong for her. And I couldn't do it anymore.
Last night, Clinton signed books at a star-studded gala at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Tonight, he'll do the same at the small storefront Hugh Mann Bookstore and Cafe in Harlem. Marva Allen is co-owner of the store. She's on the line. Marva, a little bit of excitement at the store about Bill Clinton's arrival?
Absolutely. We are hopping for sure.
How did you get this to happen?
Well, Mr. Clinton's office is about a block away from us, and we certainly wrote a letter to both his publisher and to his office asking that he come to our bookstore.
And why do you think he said yes?
Well, I think he's a part of our community.
And people have responded, I understand. How many copies did you have pre-sold?
2,100.
How many did you have?
2,100. In other words, we're sold out.
Yeah. What are people saying in the neighborhood?
People are very excited, that he's here. It seems just terribly respectful that he would honor his commitment to Harlem and be at an independent African-American bookstore.
Well, you know, even just plain independent bookstore could use a visit from a former president.
Absolutely.
But yours, as you said, it's African-American owned?
It is. It's a female owned, African-American, four partners.
What does a bookstore like this do for the neighborhood?
The bookstore is like a little mecca for our neighborhood. We've certainly become a cultural icon. We've got very famous authors who have been here, and Hillary signed here about almost a year to the date ago. And we've had Toni Morrison and some very distinguished authors come into the Harlem community, so people are very excited about the potential.
And just briefly, why do you think, I mean, this is a store with mostly African-American authors, why do you think this white president, aside from being president, is causing so much excitement in the community?
Well, I think President Clinton has always been a president of the people, and I think all people. And, you know, our name Hugh Mann represents all spectrum of color, and so we're very inclusive of anyone who falls in the hue of Hugh Mann. So I think he's just been an African-American president as much as he has been any other kind of president. He's just been a very good president.
Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Marva Allen, co-owner of the Hugh Mann Bookstore and Cafe in Harlem.
Writer Jim Harrison's work explores family and nature and how the two intertwine. He may be best known for his novella Legends of the Fall, which became a successful film in 1994. That story is about a former Army officer and his sons who live on a ranch in Montana in the early 20th century and find much to argue about when war comes to Europe.
Father, with my fluent German, I could become an officer.
Yes, and lead other young boys to the slaughter and be slaughtered yourself.
The men who served under you worshipped you.
And they were damn fools, all of them, weren't they?
This is a turning point in the history of the world. How can we
what?
Father, you can't expect us not to be part of this. You taught us.
I taught you to think for yourselves. That's what I taught you.
And to defend what's ours.
Yes, what is ours? What is ours?
Jim Harrison's newest book, True North, features a different kind of family. The main character, David Burkett, has to come to terms with a father who abuses everyone around him and with the legacy of his family's exploitation of the Michigan forests. Jim Harrison was in our studios recently, and despite a case of laryngitis, we were able to speak about his prolific career.
I had a compromise with ambition about 25 years ago. I thought to myself, I'll never complain if my books stay in print, and they're all in print, and they're an awful lot of books, you know, so that's enough.
That's the ultimate compliment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. That and a check, a paycheck is wonderful.
Well, speaking of which, at one time you were paid quite handsomely to write screenplays and certainly help pay the bills. Were you able to resist the temptation to go Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure what that means, because Of late, the book business reminds me very much of my experiences in Los Angeles, frankly. But I quit so that I wouldn't die. See, earlier in my years at writing screenplays, it was easy because they just paid you and never made the films. But then when I had three films in a row, it was just too much. It became overwhelming.
Well, and also, supposedly, the writer gets no respect. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, I don't mind that. I think, except I was in a better situation out there because I was sort of conscripted, you know, as a novelist. And also, even when you're getting cheated, you're being cheated at a level that you never dreamed of, if you get what I mean.
You write a great deal about Michigan. Obviously, it has a special place in your heart, and particularly the Upper Peninsula, the UP, mm-hmm. figures prominently in your new book, True North. What is it about Michigan and the UP that
well,
is so
that
appealing?
Particular area. I grew up in northern Michigan. Both sides of my family are farm families. But it's a lovely, remote place. I remember how many times, I think three different wolves I saw on my own little property near my cabin, which is a wonderful experience. And bears were around all the time. No people, no phone, you know, that kind of life. And I found that was the life I liked the best when I was young, and I still do.
As I was reading True North, I have to say I kept thinking about the line that has been attributed to Shakespeare and Horace and traced all the way back to Euripides about the sins of the fathers being visited on the sons. And as you've written in your memoir, you were devoted to your father, mm-hmm. which raises the question of how you were able to create such a vile character as the father in True North. What dark corner of your imagination did he come from?
Not totally, but I researched this too. This guy pushes the envelope, you know, but certainly less evil than a few fathers I've known. But it's funny how often people like that don't think they're evil, say, when I was studying the journals of big logging company owners from the 1890s, early 1900s, they're very theocratic people. They would say, if God will help me, I'll cut that 70,000 acres before Ralph Felch gets there, you know.
There's a line in the book when David is thinking about his father, and he says, how strongly we wish to love our parents beyond childhood, even when they're not good people, as this man clearly was not.
It's amazing when you see what that impulse to love your parents puts people through, too. I mean, you know, when it isn't returned. David and his sister Cynthia would have been better off if the father had left them early, but it's the only parents you're going to get.
Well, and in the end, without giving away the whole story, do you think that this father got what was coming to him?
Oh, sure. It should have happened sooner, frankly. You know, I've noticed it's with very wealthy family and sort of remote communities, if you're the richest man in town, you really have control like he did, you know?
There has to be the inevitable question as soon as you finish one book, and that is, what's next?
Well, I'm doing a second volume of this. This is from the aristocratic side of the coin, and now the second part is written from the point of view of the Anishinaabe, the local Indians, and the Finn and Cornish immigrants who were the miners and loggers. So I have to see essentially the same material from another perspective.
Well, we'll look forward to that as well. Thanks, Jim Harrison.
Thank you.
Jim Harrison's latest book is True North.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.